Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Martha!
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, I'm here to talk off the stories of films. And I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, development stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. Try really hard not to do snark. Try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how hard it is to get a movie off the ground. I cover 2 films in each episode of the podcast, and that is all the preamble we're going to do. I'm going to launch straight into the first of the two by taking you to 2016. As always, I'm setting the story up with a clip from the trailer of the film concerned, and I'll come to the tail of it, the other side of this.
Is it really surprising that the most powerful man in the world should be a figure of controversy?
We, as a population on this planet, have been looking for a savior.
We're talking about a being whose very existence,
they are not telling us the truth,
challenges our own sense of priority in the universe.
Human beings have a horrible track record of
tragedy.
Following people with great power.
Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Chaos.
Maybe he's just a guy trying to do the right
thing. We know better now, don't we?
Devils don't come from hell beneath us.
They brought their war here.
No, they come from the sky.
The world has been so caught up with what he can do that no one has asked what he should do.
Go on, go on, go on, go on.
That's how it starts.
It is indeed. And that was a clip from the trailer from 2016's Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice, written by Chris Terrio and David S. Goyer and directed by Zack Snyder, with a cast including Ben Affleck, Henry Cavill, Amy Adams, Jesse Eisenberg, Diane Lane, Lawrence Fishburne, Jeremy Irons, Holly Hunter and Gal Gadot. Batman versus Superman, then. Well, it goes back, this particular story, to the success of Zack Snyder's reboot of Superman on the big screen. Whatever you felt about 2013's Man of Steel, it gave Warner Brothers a pretty solid standalone Superman-themed hit movie, and it was enough for Warner Brothers to commit to Zack Snyder going forward for its collection of DC Comics films, certainly for him to be part of the template going forward. Just in terms of where this sat in the land of Warner Brothers and DC comic movies. 2012's The Dark Knight Rises had brought to an end Christopher Nolan's acclaimed Dark Knight trilogy, so there was no current incumbent Batman, and Nolan had been involved in realising Man of Steel and helped Zack Snyder. I think he produced the film as well. And so the immediate plan as of June 2013 was to press ahead with a Man of Steel 2. That seemed like the most likely way forward. Could Snyder turn it round by the summer of 2015? Well, that was certainly the early talk about the film as well. Henry Cavill will be back as Superman, and there you go, you get a second Superman movie. Easy, easy, easy. But then there was something a bit more ambitious brewing, because as always with Warner Brothers and its DC properties, it had a firm eye on what Marvel was building up to. And Marvel at this stage was in the early run-up to what would become Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame. And Warner Brothers was looking at it with a lot of jealousy. It wasn't the only studio in town that wanted a cinematic universe of that ilk, but it did have the comic book characters and the ingredients that should in theory have made it a lot easier to build. Now, the studio realised it would need a new Batman, it would need assorted other characters as well. And so in the midst of consideration for Man of Steel 2, there became the thought of a path to getting a DC universe done in half the time it had taken Marvel to achieve the same thing. As producer Deborah Snyder would go on to tell my colleague Ryan Lambie, she said, "I think when we were still working on Man of Steel, we were thinking about what to do next. And Zack Snyder was like, you know, I think what people really want to see is Batman and Superman together. Like, what if they were to fight?" Now, Zack Snyder is a huge fan of Frank Miller's graphic novel, The Dark Knight Returns. And as Deborah Snyder admits, that was inspiring to Zack. And she said, "Although our story is a very different story that takes place 2 years after Man of Steel left off, we all thought it was interesting. Why do they fight? Who will win? It poses a lot of questions." Well, the idea of Batman v Superman on the big screen had come forth before anyway. That Wolfgang Peterson famously nearly made a film of it in the early 2000s before Warner Brothers eventually went down the Christopher Nolan reboot route. But still, at San Diego Comic-Con 2013, just a month or two after Man of Steel to hit the big screen, people duly turned up for a panel that Warner Brothers was putting on expecting the announcement of Man of Steel 2, fairly straightforward. Only it wasn't, because Man of Steel 2 was now Batman v Superman. Now, definitely on board to direct, Zack Snyder. Also definitely on board, well, the returning cast of Man of Steel. Henry Cavill would be back, Amy Adams, Diane Lane, Lawrence Fishburne. They'd signed up for the requisite number of movies, and this was going to be the second for them all. But there was no sign of a Batman. It was decided fairly early on in the process that Christian Bale, that effectively the incumbent Batman, was a no. In fact, they'd long decided really not to link the worlds of Zack Snyder and Christopher Nolan in the DC universe on the big screen. Now, as Batman v Superman was announced, the word came through that the idea was get filming underway in early 2014, have the film ready for the summer of 2015. David S. Goyer was already at work on the script at this point. And whereas the previous Batman vs Superman project had petered out, really, I mean, that was in the aftermath of Joel Schumacher's Batman movies as well. This time it had momentum and Warner Brothers was very much foot to the floor on it. There was conversations that, I mean, Zack Snyder was having around the time. In fact, he put out a statement, says, "Let's face it, it's beyond mythological to have Superman and our new Batman," he said new Batman, "facing off, since they are the greatest superheroes in the world." Now, he was not really underselling what a big deal this was either, for Warner Brothers in particular. But fairly quickly, if they're going to start shooting in early 2014, they were going to have to sort out who the Batman was going to be. It became clear fairly early on that they were not going young, but that didn't stop around 20 names being thrown into the speculation cocktail mixer, including, I mean, they were ranging from Andrew Lincoln and Joseph Gordon-Levitt to Ryan Gosling and Richard Armitage. But by August 2013, this was moving really quickly, we knew who the new Batman was. An official studio announcement came out confirming it was Ben Affleck. This news did not go down well with a large portion of fandom. I think it would be fair to say that the blowback on that casting decision was fairly instant. Affleck had beaten out Josh Brolin to the role. In fact, Brolin would later talk about this on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. He just said it would have been the older, the more raspy Batman, for lack of a better word. He described his approach to the character and this idea of almost like a weary superhero. But Josh Brolin didn't get the role. Affleck did. And it would take a little bit of work to win a certain segment of fandom over. In fact, Affleck went on the chat show late night with Jimmy Fallon and talked about this. And he revealed that he'd been warned by Warner Brothers that the reaction to his casting might not be on the positive side. And in fact, the recommendation from the studio was to get off the internet altogether as soon as the announcement was out. Now, Affleck didn't heed this advice. The studio had shown him comments that surrounding the casting of previous superhero actors. So Michael Keaton in the original Batman movie from 1989 is a really good example. The fan backlash on that was quite intense. But Affleck, nonetheless, he ventured onto an online message board, and the first comment he said to have read was, "Affleck as Batman, no," with a lot of O's and a lot of exclamation marks. And so after that, Affleck decided, I might not have a look online, I might go off for a little bit. Instead, what he did was he launched into a training regimen that he declared that he'd hated every single day of. 2 hours a day he was working. He would have to keep this up for months and months and months and months. A release date was announced as well, July the 17th, 2015. Now, Snyder would admit close to the eventual release of the film that he'd actually envisaged at one stage casting Christian Bale in a different role in the film, just to get across the difference between his films and Christopher Nolan films. And he talked about this to an outlet called Film Inc. And he just said, this is a total and opposite reality from the Chris Nolan movies. It's another universe. So we couldn't hire Christian Bale if we wanted to, because he doesn't exist in our world. It's a bit harsh. But he did say, maybe we could hire him to play another part. We did talk about that briefly. I just wanted to hire Christian to play another part to make that obvious. Something like Alfred with age makeup. No, he was joking on that particular point. But he wanted to get across the impression that they'd actually even gone to the point of having a conversation, of bringing him into the film. In fact, Warner Brothers had initially wanted actors from Christopher Nolan's world of superheroes in Zack Snyder's playground. But Snyder was very resistant to that. Snyder would also play down that this was going to be an adaptation of the aforementioned Frank Miller comic book as well, that this was going to be very much its own thing. And casting was continuing throughout the autumn. I should know, it was really influenced by Frank Miller, no matter how much they distanced themselves from it. By December 2013, we had a Wonder Woman. Gal Gadot was cast in that particular role. What do you know? She got internet backlash. That same month, Chris Terrio, who'd penned Argo for Ben Affleck, was hired to rework the screenplay because David Goyer's schedule was preventing him committing the necessary amount of time to get Batman vs. Superman into shape. But still, the casting was coming. I mean, early 2014, in came Jeremy Irons as Alfred. Jeremy Irons recently seen in the Jason Statham action thriller The Beekeeper. Jesse Eisenberg was the next to get the casting backlash. He was the new Lex Luthor. But the thing is, people had in their head, certainly if they'd grown up with Superman on the big screen, Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor, not some guy in his late 20s, early 30s. And so, again, a lot of fan backlash. And so the casting decisions that Snyder and his team were making were not going down particularly well, but all of this was still fueled to the film's publicity machine, that there was an intense amount of interest in Batman v Superman. And then in May 2014, we had a new title for it as well. It wasn't Batman v Superman anymore. It was Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice. And so, I remember this story coming out at the time. There's a reason we got a V rather than a VS. And Snyder explained this to USA Today. The article from the paper noted that the director can't say exactly how the relationship between the two superheroes evolves. But as Snyder says, suffice it to say, there is a V in between their names in the movie title. And it's to keep it from being a straight versus movie in the most subtle way. Now, Snyder sort of had a point there. I mean, it's, I mean, we're down to semantics, really. But the general feeling when there's someone versus someone in a movie and it's two massive movie characters that are worth billions, millions, whatever, to the parent companies, none of them are actually going to die. They're all going to make it to the next film. So no one really went into the idea of Batman versus Superman thinking it's going to be a half hour film. Superman would smack Batman in the face. Batman would die and that would be your lot. That notwithstanding, he was just trying to tonally just nudge expectations a little bit as well. Warner Brothers, though, was insistent. It wanted a Batman versus Superman in the title, and we wouldn't find out till later that there was some pushback on that. That I think it was Collider that reported many, many years after the fact that the whole V instead of versus was a big negotiation between Snyder and his team and Warner Brothers as well. And Snyder had been suggesting titles such as Son of Sun and Night of Night and things like that. Chris Terrio, meanwhile, wanted the film to be called Justice League : something like that. Not, he didn't want it to be called Justice League : there would have been a subtitle afterwards, but not Batman v Superman. He wanted to put across the Justice League side of it, and Warner Brothers was very much plotting in the direction of Justice League, the kind of big time team up akin to the Avengers that it had on its assets books. May 2014, production began in Detroit. Now, filming started on Batman v Superman some 10 weeks later than originally planned, simply because they just weren't quite ready to go. There was a lot of casting, there's a lot of pre-production, there was a lot of logistics. And also, this was going to be a really long physical shoot as well, comfortably in the 100-day club, which is relatively rare now, certainly for very big films. The further casting tidbits would be leaking out. Jason Momoa was joining as Aquaman, Ezra Miller as The Flash, Ray Fisher as Cyborg, all pieces of casting that would have ramifications for DC and Warner Brothers down the line in a lot of different ways. Production had only been going for a few weeks before it was back off to San Diego Comic-Con as well, where a first teaser was screened for Batman v Superman, one that wouldn't go online. Now, I was working at Denner Geek at the time. I was reporting on this from afar, and I saw the internet light up as the first footage was shown from Batman v Superman, and just these intense glowing eyes and just the very different tonal shift the film was clearly taking. Now, just to give some degree of comparison as to just how much chatter there was, this was the same San Diego Comic-Con where Marvel was talking about its upcoming Avengers Age of Ultron, the second Avengers film, which, given that the first one had blasted past $1 million, so expectations were sky high for that. But it was Batman versus Superman that was gaining the most chatter at that point, where the fan interest was just really just at number one spot for that particular San Diego Comic-Con. Now, by August 2014, with everyone back from San Diego and now filming again, that came the news that the film was changing release dates again, and it was looking for a clash. I mean, it's heading towards a clash at this stage with Captain America: Civil War, because Marvel had dated that film for May 2016, and for a while it looked like Batman v Superman might arrive around that time. Now, it clearly wasn't going to turn up in 2015, and so it was a case of, will Marvel blink or will Warner Brothers blink? And it was very much Warner Brothers that blinked. It moved Batman vs Superman to a March 2016 release date. Now, this was, this was quite a thing, really, because big superhero films, we've seen it a lot since, they weren't out in March. They were for summer, occasionally for Christmas at an absolute push, but this was an unusual slot for such a huge, huge, huge film. But then Warner Brothers was more than doubling down on its gamble on Batman v Superman, because as it moved the date, it announced plans for 9 more DC movies as it did so. It was a very, very long shoot. As I said before, I think it was 134 days in the end. Although I should note that not every actor appeared on set. Not every actor you see on screen appeared on set. That Michael Shannon, for one, who'd appeared as General Zod in Man of Steel, didn't actually shoot any new scenes for the film. And instead, what the production used was, I'm going to spoil a lot as I can, a rubber dummy of General Zod And so, as Shannon would reflect many years later, in the movie, there's a large rubber version of my naked body that Lex Luthor's playing with. And he says, I was not. The only thing I did for it was I did some of the ADR of some lines that Zach thought he might use in the movie of my spirit talking to Lex Luthor. But that was it. I mean, his presence was there, but he was not physically on set at any point. There wasn't a lot of tittle-tattle from the shoot itself, save for the usual leaking of photos that Warner Brothers amped the anticipation levels for this so much and put such a veil of secrecy over it that inevitably there was a clamour to get pictures of people on set. I mean, it was shooting in Detroit at first. It was out in the open at certain points as well. Jesse Eisenberg, someone who just said he really hated doing the San Diego Comic-Con, not his happy place at all, was having to go in undercover to the set. Otherwise, that his look of Lex Luthor and his shaved head would be revealed early. They wanted to keep that under wraps, and so they basically put him under wraps. Hans Zimmer was hired to do the music. He would go on to say this was going to be his last superhero film as well. And I mean, Eisenberg also is worth noting. I mean, for a scripted film as well, he was playing with his dialogue a little bit, just trying to get slightly different reactions from the people he was acting against. But to the frustration of the studio, things were just still leaking. In fact, as Deborah Snyder would say, one of the hardest things on it was the piracy aspect of the film. She said, we tried to do things for the fans. We tried to make an announcement to give to the fans at Comic-Con. It gets spoiled. We tried to do a fan event with just the Uber fans who'd signed up at IMAX theatres, and somewhere in Brazil a trailer got leaked. And she said it's just a shame because you want to give them something because of how loyal and how excited they are for the movie, and we just don't get to do it because it goes all over the internet. And she did say it's just really frustrating. She and producer Charles Roven also said the toughest part of this for a producer was actually the scheduling. A lot of actors had to be juggled that very, very long schedule. The fact that they were zipping around as well, that they shot in Michigan and then it would be the snowiest winter on record in Michigan. And then they, I mean, just getting around at certain points was very, very difficult. And as Deborah Snyder says, with the longevity, making sure you came in with your A game every day when you get physically tired from the long hours and being outside a lot, that was a real challenge. Filming would wrap up in December 2014, but it was still going to be a long time before we saw the film. I remember this at the time. Just like footage was coming out in the summer of 2014, and that was nearly 2 years before the film was actually in cinemas. The build-up to the film was as elongated as any I can remember, certainly in the world of superhero films, in that the studio was deliberately putting materials out so far in advance. Heading into early 2015, as editing was well underway, the speculation was rife that Batman vs. Superman was now going to be split into two films. Now, Henry Cavill was asked about this in an interview, and he duly denied that at the start of 2015. He was telling the truth as well. He had another movie out that summer of 2015, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I've covered on a previous episode of this very podcast. And he was on that one. I mean, he wasn't being asked so much about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., he's been asked about Batman vs. Superman. He was absolutely insistent that Batman vs. Superman wasn't Man of Steel 2, and you know, the hype machine was just kept being pumped up. And even a good year ahead of release, the Warner Brothers marketing machine was really gearing up for the movie. I mean, it was an abundance of tie-in deals were secured, and the studio in the end also spent around $160 million just on promoting the film. The production budget of the film, I mean, that was not cheap. I mean, $250 to $300 million are the estimates, as expensive a superhero film as Warner Brothers had made at that point. But then the studio had seen a rough cut of the film and was reportedly thrilled about this, and so things were looking really positive. So even as we were all gearing up to see the film, Warner Brothers was plotting what was coming next, and in particular there were going to be two Justice League movies. Now, the studio didn't want to wait around. It was playing such levels of catch-up with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. As soon as it had its next film to go, it just wanted it in front of the cameras. And it wanted its superheroes together for a Justice League Part 1 that was going to start filming the month after Batman vs. Superman made it into cinemas. So this was, it wasn't quite as fast a turnaround as it might look, given that Batman vs. Superman had finished shooting well over a year before production began on Justice League. Justice League. But it would mean that the cast and the director and the producer of the crew would be out promoting Batman vs. Superman. And then weeks later, they already had a lock script for Justice League and they were going to be filming that, even as Batman vs. Superman was playing in cinemas. So there were, then it was a case of, well, what's this film like? How's this one going to go down? And again, I watched the social media feed from the world premiere, and social media feeds of after premieres are almost universally positive. And I was reading stuff about how this is one of the best superhero films of all time. This is amazing. This is brilliant. This is incredible. This is superb. And then we all saw it. And so I am utterly respectful of the fact that there are some people who very passionately go out to bat for this film. I sort of wish you'd go out to bat also for $5 million films, but I understand that the film would get an awful lot of criticism and there would be a sizable amount of fandom that would go out to heavily bat for it, as they have for Zack Snyder's work, where he's had pushback in the past. I mean, Sucker Punch didn't go down well, for instance. More recently, we've had the first Rebel Moon film. That didn't go down well either, but there are people fighting his corner. The general critical response, though, I mean, at the very best, was begrudging, like, 3-star reviews pretty much across the board, if not worse than that, actually. That just, I mean, there was the novelty of seeing these two characters on the screen at the same time. But it was a 2.5-hour downbeat film with not a lot of fun to it. I mean, not a lot of levity to it. And in terms of what people were expecting from such films, it couldn't really be tonally more apart from what Marvel was doing and what Warner Brothers was in the end ultimately aiming for. Now, that was sort of what Zack Snyder was in for. It had its advocates. I do want to note that again. And also, the performances of Ben Affleck, Jesse Eisenberg and Gal Gadot, I mean, they came in for a lot of praise as well. I mean, quite a few people were eating their words there. And then the film opened in cinemas. I mean, ultimately, it's down to the audience, right? The audience will decide if this is going to be a big monster hit. And with the watermark being $1 billion gross, which is what the two Avengers films had done to this point, Batman v Superman opened with a gigantic opening weekend as well. I mean, very, very positive news. If we just go to the US opening weekend, which was March 25th to the 27th of 2016, $166 million. That's fantastic numbers. And I mean, it was a busy weekend as well. I mean, Disney's Zootropolis Zootopia was in second place with $24 million. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 opened with $17 million that weekend. Then the other stuff that was around, Miracles from Heaven was in the top five. Allegiant was in the top five as well. 10 Cloverfield Lane had been hanging around. Deadpool was in its second month of release. $350 million it had grossed at that point off, what, a $60 million budget? They will be looking closely at that. London Has Fallen, My Name is Doris and Risen were the other films that were rounding out the chart. The problem, the warning signs came with the word of mouth and the second weekend drop off, because there wasn't a big blockbuster film opening against Batman vs. Superman for its second weekend. People had given it a wide berth. The drop off was an alarming near 70%. The second weekend gross was $51 million. This was clearly going to make a lot of money, but it was not necessarily going to make a lot of profit. The only film that opened over $5 million that weekend was God's Not Dead 2, which helped itself to $7 million for fourth place. And even the week after, there wasn't a big blockbuster film. I mean, there was a comedy starring Melissa McCarthy, The Boss, and that knocked Batman vs. Superman off the top slot with $23 million on its third weekend. It just eked out the number one position. And then along came Disney's The Jungle Book, Barbershop the next cut the week after. So Batman vs. Superman was hanging around the top five for quite a while. But still, its total American gross of $330 million was on the lower side of what Warner Brothers wanted. No one was calling it a disaster, but still, it wasn't at the level the studio wanted. And particularly disappointing was the $544 million it grossed outside of America. The worldwide take for Batman vs. Superman, $874 million. Now, for you, me, for virtually every other movie on the planet, that is an enormous amount of money. But for everything that Warner Brothers have put into the film, let's just conservatively say $250 million to make, $150 million to market, that $400 million just to get to the screen. If you say charitably, it gets half the box office take. It was struggling to break even. The bigger problem was the response to it was not great. That there were complaints about how dark it was, and was this a miserable film? Was this just like relentlessly dour? I mean, this was the kind of stuff that Warner Brothers was reading, and also it had exactly the same creative team working on the next big film, the potentially the biggest film it had made, in theory, a Justice League movie. This should be Warner Brothers' easiest $1 billion ever. The response to Batman vs. Superman just spooked the studio, and it in turn demanded very, very fast changes to Justice League. In fact, it rustled up a very quick press trip to the set of Justice League so that Zack Snyder and his team could respond to what was being said about Batman vs. Superman. Yeah, we read the reviews, they say, which this will be a totally different film. In fact, Warner Brothers would in the end mandate that it wanted Justice League to be 2 hours, that it would want it to be lighter, it wanted to have more humour in it. And in the end, we only got a Justice League Part 1. I mean, the whole Justice League story I will do in a future episode at one point. Snyder, though, wasn't necessarily done with Batman vs. Superman, because he would present, and not for the last time in his career, an alternate cut of the film with 31 more minutes of footage that would turn up on the eventual Blu-ray, 4K and DVD release as an option. Now, what this would add was Jenna Malone's character from the film would be reinstated, completely cut out of the theatrical cut, and there was a lot more Superman in it, and fans of Snyder's work are very, very passionate about what's regarded as the ultimate cut of Batman vs Superman. Not the director's cut, not the extended cut, the ultimate cut, and they chose that name particularly. Both versions are happily out there, the theatrical version and Snyder's preferred cut, and so you can't say it's judged on a studio hacked together version as Justice League was for a while. But there was no getting around the fact, really, that the film hadn't done what the studio wanted or really needed it to do. In fact, months after the release, Michael Shannon would tell Fandango that he just fell asleep watching it, that he was far more into Man of Steel. And he just said, and Affleck would go on to say, I can understand people saying Batman v Superman was too dark, or this was outside the tone of what I'm used to seeing with a Batman story. I think that's a fair criticism. He was off filming material for Suicide Squad as well. He would turn up in that. And Affleck's tenure as Batman, well, for a while it looked like it was going to be extended. He was made an executive producer on Justice League Part 1, a shooting very much underway. And as Justice League Part 1 was shooting, the slate of films was confirmed. 2 Justice Leagues, Cyborg standalone movie, The Flash standalone movie, Aquaman standalone movie. But for Zack Snyder, he was at that point knee-deep in the first of what was planned to be those 2 Justice League films. Batman vs. Superman, I mean, lots of questions were being asked. Questions were being asked, too, as to whether Warner Brothers had really understood comic book movies and cinematic universe, not least when Marvel released just a month or two later Captain America Civil War in cinemas, so basically a dry run for a full Avengers film. And let's just say Captain America Civil War worldwide gross of $1.1 billion on a slightly cheaper, well, roughly the same, but slightly cheaper marketing, I think, was pretty much more what Warner Brothers was after. The story of the Snyderverse, though, would continue, and I will come to it again. But for the second half of this episode, I'm going to a 1990s superhero film, which I'll come to just after I do these parish announcements, because we are at the halfway stage of the latest Film Stories podcast. So I'm going to pause so I can put the ad thing in here. And now I'm back after the ad thing. So a couple of parish announcements, really. First of all, if you like this podcast and don't mind giving it a bit of support, you can subscribe. That costs you nothing. If you subscribe at your podcast home of choice, that's wonderful. Much appreciated. Likewise, if you leave ideally a hugely positive review, stuff like this is gold dust to independent podcasts that don't have major corporations behind them. And algorithms like it when you do things like that. It's the game. Don't like the game, but that's the game we're in. If you want to go further and put some coins in the pot, if you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew, that's where you will, in exchange for your generosity and kindness, thank you, then you will get the podcast early pretty much every week. You'll get it ad free. You'll find out gossip of what I'm up to behind the scenes as well. One more thing on the notices front. I'm just about to put on sale the latest issues of Film Stories that are going through production at the moment. They're not quite out, they're not quite finished, but I'll be putting them up for pre-order soon. I love print film magazines. I've now made over 60 of them under the Film Stories and Film Juniors name. Find them at store.filmstories.co.uk. I'm also shortly to be adding, this should be fun, some video film stories to youtube.com/filmstories. Given that I have a lazy eye, that should be quite interesting. I'm really looking forward to the comments. But I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. And so, as always, I'm going to set it up with a clip from the trailer. I'll come to the next tale just after this.
Just take a look around. Darkness rules the earth.
In a dangerous world.
Governments crumble. Chaos reigns.
In a treacherous time.
There is opportunity in chaos.
Evil is a fact.
We shall succeed where they have failed.
Drax is on a quest for a supernatural power.
They know far too much.
And courage.
Stop them. You're the only one who can.
Is a phantom.
Somebody I already killed.
There are some who say he is only a myth. Soon they will discover the Phantom is real.
That then was the trailer for 1996's The Phantom, directed by Simon Windsor, written by Jeffrey Boehm and based on The Phantom by Lee Falk. A cast led by Billy Zane, also Treat Williams, Christy Swanson, Catherine Zeta-Jones, James Remar and Patrick McGoohan also in the lineup. The world of superhero movies then in the 1990s was very different to the one in the 2010s. That in 1989 we'd had Batman from Tim Burton, and that had convinced movie studios that, you know what, it might be worth going and having a look at all these superheroes after all. 1990 though brought Dick Tracy from Disney, starring and directed by Warren Beatty, and this was a film that Disney infamously spent a lot of time and resource on, and it only just really broke even. That it didn't do Batman style numbers, and then when 1991's excellent The Rocketeer really just kind of fell short at the box office significantly, this mini superhero boom outside of Batman was felt to be over. That said, the idea of Lee Falk's creation, the Phantom, the ghost that walks, and of bringing him to the screen had been around for some time. Now, the character of the Phantom was created in 1937 as a comic strip rather than a comic book. Falk would be involved right up until his passing in 1999. He'd already enjoyed success creating Mandrake the Magician, and the Phantom would go on to be a feature film and an animated series. For those of us of a certain age, you would have found the Phantom in the animated TV series Defenders of the Earth, which was hugely popular for a long period of time. But even before we got there, an unlikely name was interested in doing a film of the Phantom. That would be Sergio Leone, the same person who directed the spaghetti westerns, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, For a Few Dollars More, Fistful of Dollars, those films. And he met with Lee Falk with the idea of doing a movie based on the Phantom, and this was back in the 1960s. He'd already had a look and kicked the tires of a possible film based on Flash Gordon, but various issues meant that that couldn't go ahead. And then he moved, he had a look at Mandrake the Magician instead. But after doing a little bit of questioning and having a meeting with Falk as well about the possibility of this, a different film of his would come together, his masterpiece as it happened, Once Upon a Time in the West. And so he went off and made that instead. And so the Phantom just limbered back into the development archive with no sign of a film on the horizon. But going back to 1989's Batman, that did mean that studios were now actively looking at comic books for source material again. I mean, they hadn't really done that in the 1980s because not many of the comic book movies of the 1980s did very well at all. But Paramount Pictures picked up the screen rights to have a go at The Phantom, and it soon found a director as well, the brilliant Joe Dante, who at this point was not long off making Gremlins 2 The New Batch, one of my favourite sequels of all time. And, Joe Dante had by this stage as well scored a hit with Innerspace, the original Gremlins 2. And so he brought in Jeffrey Boehm, the late screenwriter who he collaborated with on Innerspace, to put a script together. Now, many years ago, I had the chance to interview Joe Dante, and I asked him just kind of what went on with The Phantom, and he told me, he said, I developed the script with the late Jeff Boehm, who wrote Innerspace, and they wrote it as a kind of spoof. Now, this got quite a way down the line as well, that he would reflect that we were weeks away from shooting in Australia when the plug was pulled over the budget and the presence of a winged demon at the climax. And he said a year or so later, it was put back into production. A little bit of a spoiler there. Sans the demon, only nobody seemed to notice it was written to be funny. And so in Dante's view, it was, quote, disastrously played straight. Many unintentionally funny moments were cut after a raucous test screening. And I foolishly refused money to take my name off the picture, so I'm credited as one of a zillion producers. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, a long way ahead of ourselves, because Paramount was still interested in pressing ahead with the movie, even though it had pulled the plug fairly late in the day, Joe Dante's particular take on the material. And so next up, well, there was apparently a conversation with Joel Schumacher. Now, Schumacher at the start of the 1990s he hadn't done a Batman film at that point. But how far those conversations went is unknown. And I mean, Schumacher would become one of Warner Brothers' stable of like premium blockbuster directors not long after. I think 1993's Falling Down was really the turning point project for Schumacher at Warner Brothers. Then he did The Client, the John Grisham adaptation, and then he was on to Batman Forever. So for the point of this story, he wasn't directing The Phantom. 1994, then, we go into there, and there were still comic book-based movies. I mean, The Crow and The Shadow both came out. I've covered The Shadow before. I will get to The Crow at some point. And they'd enjoyed, it would be fair to say, very, very different fates. And particularly with The Shadow and The Rocketeer, it's worth noting that these were period-based superhero comic book productions that weren't resonating. Was the problem like the period setting? Well, could that hurt something like The Phantom? Who knows? And so Paramount decided it was going to press ahead. Now, Simon Windsor at that point had made a really good Western, actually, Quigley Down Under. And Alan Rickman was almost regularly reminded that he'd done two villain roles, but actually very few people reminded him of the third that he'd done. He played the villain in this Western, really good Western starring Tom Selleck, Quigley Down Under. Windsor's career, though, well, he had a background in television, which meant that he could turn things around relatively quickly. And so he was brought on board very, very late in the day, the film Free Willy, which was heading towards production, and he got it made. He got it made, turned it into a hit. I don't think it's anyone's idea of an absolute masterpiece of a movie, but kickstarted a franchise, did what it needed to do, and Windsor proved that he could deliver a film to standard and to time. This was all good news and useful for him, and so he was hired by Disney pretty much immediately-ish after that to make a film called Operation Dumbo Drop, which he would go off to make in Thailand. And as Windsor would reflect to Slash Film, he was just about to go off to London to score Operation Dumbo Drop, or to oversee the scoring of the film, more to the point. But he took a phone call from Paramount Pictures just before he was set to leave. Now, Paramount Pictures had some urgency here because it had now been suddenly looking to fill a gap in its 1996 summer release schedule, given that its planned film of The Saint, which was set to star Val Kilmer, had just been put back by 6 months. So Paramount already had the first Mission Impossible film lined up for the summer of 96. It needed another movie, and it had this gap. And it also had in its locker a working script for The Phantom, just no director, and not quite a Phantom at this point. And so, as Windsor would explain, I literally went to Paramount on the way to Los Angeles Airport on my way to London for Operation Dumbo Drop. And he met with Sherry Lansing at the studio, and they said, we'd love you to do the film. That's the good news. The bad news is we want it for next June. So we're in the summer of 1995 here, and The Phantom Winton was required for the summer of 1996, and Simon Winton would have less than a year to make the film. Hadn't read the script yet, so took a copy of that onto his flight, had a read, and when he landed, he agreed to make the film. It's just like, yeah, we'll do it, and went straight into casting for the film. Paramount was putting aside, I mean, $55-ish million to make the movie. It was going to be quite a big deal. But then he took another look at its no doubt very, very polished Excel spreadsheet just before and decided that, I mean, it just looked a bit too expensive. I mean, The Shadow, just a year or two before, just hadn't done the numbers. Did it really want to be spending so much money on The Phantom? I mean, this was a couple of years after it had cut the budget on Beverly Hills Cop 3, for instance, and also on Forrest Gump. And so Simon Winter found himself in a position where he was auditioning for one of the key roles in the film, the part that ultimately went to Catherine Zeta-Jones. But at this moment, as he took the phone call, Jennifer Lopez was in the room auditioning for that particular role, and he had to listen to Paramount while the auditions were going on. Paramount just said that the budget is not right, and it had planned to make this film in Mexico and Hawaii, but it just wasn't coming in on the cheap side. Now, what Simon Winter remembered was Operation Dumbo Drop was made for Disney. Disney, a very, very frugal studio at this point in its lifetime. And it had decided to shoot that film in Thailand, where it had been made for an awful lot less. And so what happened was Simon Winter, once he'd done his day of auditions, he went through the script later that day and he just changed the locations around. He switched it to away from Hawaii and away from Mexico, and instead Los Angeles, Thailand, Queensland would be the places he would set the film. So the following morning, he was back in Paramount Pictures offices. They weren't really sure about shooting in Thailand, but in the end they signed off because this looked like it could finally happen. It really wanted and needed the film, and so location scouting could fairly quickly get underway in Thailand, as it duly did. Now, there's still the title role of The Phantom, and for a while it looked as though Bruce Campbell was the running favourite, good old Bruce Campbell. But auditions pitted him against Billy Zane. Now, Billy Zane had come onto the radar particularly for his excellent performance in Philip Noyce's movie Dead Calm, and it turned out he was a bit of a fan of the comic book as well, that a fairly recent fan as well. Now, I have read a couple of conflicting stories. One that said Simon Winter cast Billy Zane as the Phantom, but Winter himself, going back to that Slash Film interview, said that Zane was pretty much already attached when he came aboard. As for Billy Zane himself, he spoke to EDRHollywoods.com and said, "I hadn't read The Phantom as a child. I was only introduced to it in Australia during the making of Dead Calm." And he said, "I was just so intrigued by this completely accessible naturalist hero that I tried to embody Phantom consciousness in my day to day to increase my compassion and awareness and capacity for good deeds while trying to mimic the behaviour and body language." And he just said it was just something he picked up from the comic, and so it spoke to him. He said, "It brought out the superhero in me. I thought it was such a relief a character like this was available for me to bring to the screen." And so when it came, I mean, he would land the role. And he said, "As far as the research was concerned, I just tried to embody what I thought were the virtues of the character. Not unlike Ben Affleck with Batman vs Superman. As soon as you're cast as a superhero, you have to hit the gym. You have to get down to work." And in the case of Billy Zane, he worked for up to a year and a half with a trainer called Tom Mozilla before the cameras were switched on. As Zane would say, "He introduced me to a lot of very interesting techniques, including a Zen-like exercise with an 8-pound ball. For where I'm sitting, that sounds like absolute hell, but fair play to him. He said, for practice, we once stalked through Griffith Park, rolling around with fake guns, and the park rangers chased us away. Again, that must have been quite a day." The actor also studied many of the cat-like movements from the Phantom comic strips, and he just ruminated that the poses introduced by Lee Falk were really great, and I just tried to take that body language into the film. Now, Winter was now playing with a budget closer to $40, $45 million. The film was now going ahead, and it was going to kick off filming in Los Angeles on October the 3rd, 1995. There was some shooting done around the Playboy Mansion, I gather. It's not a place I've got any intent to go, nor have I been invited, to be honest. The Hugh Hefner at that point was not dead, and thus he granted use of the exterior of the mansion For use in the film. Apparently he was a fan of The Phantom as well. Who knew? The film also shot in Los Angeles Zoo that was doubling for, I think it was for New York. It was doubling for another zoo. And then the production would head off to Thailand for around 2 months. Then it was off to Australia. They broke for Christmas in the midst of it all. And then it was heading back to Los Angeles to finish it all off. And as Winter recalled, it was a very, very happy shoot. He did say, I remember we got miles behind schedule because the monsoon kind of hung over in Thailand. And Sherry Lansing, who was heading up Paramount Pictures at that particular point, came to visit the set. It was running over schedule. She wanted to see where the money was going. And Winter said, we were filming Summer in the Jungle and it started to piss with rain. Oh, there's a line. And she said, so when we got back in the hotel, wading through the foyer in ankle deep water, she just said, I totally understand why you're behind schedule. And it was fine. Now, that didn't mean the release date wasn't fixed. June the 7th, 1996, is when Paramount Pictures wanted to release The Phantom. As it turned out, it would be when Paramount Pictures released The Phantom. But still, she was understanding of why they were having so much trouble. Filming would, in the end, conclude on February the 13th, 1996. So that's less than 4 months, I make it, ahead of the release of the film. As I often say on this podcast, this was in the era before digital distribution, so you had to knock a couple of weeks off to strike the prints and to physically ship them around the world, around the country. But still, the film was over into the edit room. And Winter, again, working from a TV background, he had a pair of credited editors, O. Nicholas Brown and Brian H. Carroll. One of the things when I look at Michael Mann films on the podcast as well, it's the same with him, that because he comes from a television background, the edit takes the preparation quite a lot of time. The edit less time than you might actually think. And so the film was pretty much ready. And I mean, previews were sorted. And going back to the Slash Film interview, Simon Winter said, I remember we had a preview at the Directors Guild one Sunday morning for families, and it just got this fantastic reaction. And Sherry Lansing was railing at all of her executives. She was saying, this film's opening in 10 days and no one knows it's happening. What are we going to do? And therein lay the problem. That for all Paramount trying to get the movie out in the world, and for all the fact that it had had a success that summer already with the first Mission Impossible film, raising audience awareness of The Phantom was proving incredibly tricky. And it was the case that just ahead of the release of the film, awareness of it was really low. Now, it was part of a very famous milk marketing campaign at that point, so there were the odd bits of crossover, but this wasn't Batman level kind of stuff. Paramount wasn't spending mega bucks either on the marketing of its films. I mean the poster didn't say an awful lot. I mean, it is Billy Zane as the Phantom with Slam Evil as well, but there was nothing really that was igniting an awful lot of excitement unless you happen to already be a huge fan of the Phantom comic strips. Here then lay the problem, as The Phantom, I mean, first of all, it went before critics, and I mean, the reception to it was just nothing special at all. It was pretty much the usual drill, actually, that, I mean, as much as the period look of it was liked and enjoyed, the film itself was never really marked out as anything particularly special. In fact, I think, if anything, it's regarded better now than it was at the time, and that's also something that comes up an awful lot on this podcast too. But the response to it, the reviews just weren't suggesting anything close to a breakout here, and if anything, just a quiet and fairly just restrained and not particularly demonstrative film. It thus went into cinemas in a very competitive summer on the weekend of June the 7th to the 9th, 1996, with Mission Impossible had been out for 3 weeks, was already at 130 million just on US box office. But The Phantom would only open in sixth place. It would be sinking fairly quickly. The big opener it was against that week was The Rock, starring Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage, directed by Michael Bay. It is Michael Bay's best film. 25 million opening for The Rock. Mission Impossible, 14 million on its third weekend. Twister, 11 million on its fifth weekend. Dragonheart on its second weekend, 7.6 million. Eddie with Whoopi Goldberg from Disney, very frugal film again, 5.5 $2.5 million on its second weekend. The Phantom $5 million and $72,000 with $346 at the end of that as well. It was not a good opening. There's no way to paint that in much of a positive light. The rest of the chart was filled out by films that were also struggling a little bit. Spy Hard didn't do an awful lot. The Arrival didn't do much. Flipper, not great guns. Truth About Cats and Dogs broke out a little bit, though. That's a really smart film. I've got a huge amount of time for that. The following week, The Phantom found itself up against one of the most divisive films of that summer. Jim Carrey headlining The Cable Guy, earning a record salary for a movie star at that point, but not really delivering a massive hit film. For a lot of reasons, which I will go to in a future episode of the podcast. That was the big opener, but The Phantom, $3 million on its second weekend, it lost 40% of its business. It just wasn't going to break out. The word of mouth wasn't working. The week after, out came Arnold Schwarzenegger and Eraser, the Disney animation, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I've covered both of those. By the time The Phantom left US cinemas, it had, $17 million in its back pocket, and that was just about that. It only did another $5 or $6 million overseas, and any hopes of any kind of sequel or any kind of legacy thing there just was pretty much gone. Zane would eventually reflect on the film that there was just a lot cut out of it in the end. I mean, go back to those Joe Dante comments at the start as well about just there was a version of it that was never fully changed, really. The script that Windsor picked up was the one that Jeffrey Boehm had written and had a different tone, really, to the kind of film that was put out. Zane would say there was a lot cut out. There was more backstory into the character that I wished had remained on screen. Introductions to certain characters as well, tours around the place. And so he was unhappy with just how it panned out. He just felt there was a better film in the midst of it all. However, for his career, it would have some interesting knock-ons. I mean, first of all, he was asked how it would affect his career. I mean, what would he take away? And this is interesting because he said he would take away greater diplomacy in relationship in working with the directors. Now, I couldn't get any deeper on that at all, but was it a happy production? I don't know. I mean, Simon Windsor certainly didn't seem to think so. And Zane said much else to the contrary. And he just said, beyond my working life, it heightened my capacity for compassion, sensitivity, increased my access to the living library, and for his career, it would apparently be pivotal in James Cameron casting him in a role in a film that he was working on at that point by the name of Titanic. That one worked out particularly well for Zane, a lot better than The Phantom. That said, The Phantom, I think, is just quite an innocent slice of cinema. A good chunk of fun as well. I mean, I always enjoyed The Phantom. It's never been one of my absolute favourite films, but it's always a reliable piece of entertainment. And I mean, it keeps coming back on DVD and Blu-ray, that people keep taking the time to bring it out and try and find a new audience. I think it will always at best be a bit of a cult film at most, really. There's not been a lot of appetite to revisit The Phantom on the big screen either. So for now, what we're left with is this 1996 film that in the end was rushed to the screen to fill a gap left by The Saint, which would follow the following year. And I'll come to that one in a future episode. And a better film, really, than I think history has really given it credit for. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me. I'm more on Blue Sky, actually, in terms of social networking at the moment. I'm quite enjoying it there again. I'm Simon Brew at Blue Sky. I'm on Twitter still at Simon Brew. Film Stories is on both Blue Sky and on Twitter at Film Stories, so do say hello to us there. On Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We're on YouTube, youtube.com/filmstories. If you go to, where else can you go? You can go to our website, which is filmstories.co.uk. That's updated every weekday with movie news, reviews, features, video games, TV, all sorts of things we're trying to do there. We are trying to build a non-clickbait film and entertainment website, which is very, very hard to do. And so I can't thank enough everybody somebody who's seen what we're trying to do there, seen what we're trying to push against, and is supporting us is massively appreciated. I've never known it quite this difficult, and I'm glad we're still somehow going. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that is where you will find our abundance of print film magazines for sale, and also our Blu-rays of Bull Durham and No Way Out UK exclusive Blu-rays. We put our own extras on as well, so thank you to everyone who's done that. Finally, the Patreon again is patreon.com/Simon Brew, but I've thoroughly outstayed my welcome. But last thing for me to say is the most important thing, really, that you all stay safe and you all stay well. I'm off to watch another load of films now. I've got more special episodes coming up too. Main thing for now is you all look after yourself. Take care. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories.